Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCaine. Today we will talk about transformational leadership. As progressives, we work hard on a variety of important issues such as education, income equality, food safety and the environment, and decent housing. Yet despite hard work and some significant successes, we don't seem to be making enough headway to create the kind of country we really want. The dream of everyone having a good education, a good job with a living wage, decent housing, and a secure retirement seems further away than ever. Certainly one of the major reasons why this is happening is the amount of money that wealthy people like the Koch brothers pour into the political system, distorting policies in favor of big business and the wealthy. But are there other reasons? Social change requires leaders. What kind of leaders are emerging now in the progressive movement? What kind of leaders do we need to deal with the significant challenges of a democracy at risk of corporate domination, economic structures that lock out millions of people, and damage to our biosphere? How do we become the leaders needed to bring about the success of progressive values and the progressive agenda? Here to talk with us about these and other issues is Robert Gass, who is widely known and highly regarded for his work in leadership development and organizational change over the past 30 years. He has worked as an executive coach and organizational consultant to Fortune 500 companies, nonprofits, and foundations, and offered seminars to more than 100,000 individuals at universities, education centers, and conferences around the world. Robert is co-founder of the Rockwood Leadership Institute, where he designed and delivers Leading from the Inside Out, a year-long leadership training for top social change leaders. Graduates of this program form the core of the Social Transformation Project Network. He is the former president of ARC International, a global consulting and training company specializes in transformational change with Fortune 500 companies. Robert has a doctorate in clinical psychology and organizational development from Harvard University. He was board chair of Greenpeace USA. His clients have included the U.S. Senate and Congress, SEIU, the Democracy Alliance, the Tides Foundation, Sierra Club, MoveOn.org, and senior leaders in the Obama administration, among others. Robert is deeply passionate about bringing a transformational approach to leadership, organizational development, and large systems change to those working for social, racial, and environmental justice. He co-founded the Social Transformation Project to encourage this paradigm shift. Robert and Judith Ansara, his wife and life partner of more than 40 years, lead retreats for committed couples throughout North America. Robert is also well known as a recording artist and performing musician. Robert Gass, welcome to All Together Now. Robert Gass, are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me?
There we go. Wonderful. Welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you, and I'm glad to be here.
You sound like a real Renaissance man with all these incredible achievements in all these domains, so thank you for your great work.
Oh, thank you. It is really strange. Like, that was a long introduction, Eleanor. It's like, wow, did I do those things?
All right. Good. Well, you've done a lot. So today we want to talk about transformational leadership. So I'd like to just start by simply asking you, what is transformational leadership?
Sure. It's, I'll kind of talk around with some of the characteristics of what I think this approach is. I would say, a number of years ago, I saw this quote, which apparently has become, it's a bumper sticker these days, but from Gandhi. It said, "We must be the change we want to see in the world." And I think that captures, in a sense, the heart of transformational leadership. It's about that who we are creates the results we want in the world. You can't really be violent to fight for peace. that we actually have to be the change that we want to see. So that's kind of one of the fundamental principles of transformational leadership that we teach. Another thing is that transformational leadership is very oriented towards creation. In social change work, it's very natural. There's so many things that are rather upsetting and frustrating and make us actually furious and painful to watch. It's very natural to kind of approach the world through, like, what we don't like and what we're against. And that's a good thing. It's important. But in transformational leadership, we're also really focused on what is it we want to create? What is the positive vision? And about hope. Because a lot of things we look at in the world create a feeling of despair or helplessness or fear. And powerful change actually comes out of aspiration. It comes out of hope. It comes out of dreaming. So that's another fundamental principle of transformation leadership. It's about creation. It's about hope. It's about what we want. It's also a systemic approach. Some people tend towards what we may call kind of the softer parts, the kind of human elements of change. Other people may focus on the structures that have to change. A transformation leader actually integrates all of that. What's actually necessary to create endurable change? Transformational leadership is very much about collaboration, about the appreciation of interdependence. A lot of people rise to power in leadership positions, both in the progressive world, but frankly in all places in our society, tend to have large egos, and it can end up being like, it's about me. That's what leadership is. And a transformational leadership really has that orientation towards servant leadership, and also has, maybe a pretty frank way of saying it, has their ego in check enough so that when they come out to the world to create change, it's not just about me, it's about us. And particularly in these days of complexity and globalization and the rapidity of communication, everything is about collaboration. Everything requires collaboration for any kind of change to happen. I'd say the last two things about a transformational approach to leadership, it engages the heart as well as the mind. When I train leaders, I try to shock them the first day by saying, you have to be a spiritual leader. I don't mean a spiritual, religious leader. If you look at the great political leaders, they capture the human heart. They capture the human spirit. It wasn't throwing a bunch of facts at people. And so a transformation leadership has everything to do with the heart, with the human spirit. And the last thing I'd say is, most of our traditional models of leadership, they're pretty male, frankly. And it tends to be more orientation around control. And yes, that power to focus, to push, to make things happen, that's an important part of leadership. But in transformation leadership, we try to bring it into a balance. In Chinese philosophy, there's a sense of kind of yang, that's the kind of male principle, that kind of powerful outward focus, pushing, making it happen. But also needs to be balanced by the yin, the receptive, the allowing. And that's underdeveloped in many of our leaders. And so in transformation leadership, we're trying to find that balance of it's kind of captured in the AA prayer, know when it's time to try to make things happen, when it's time to let go, to surrender, and to know the difference between the two. So those are some of the characteristics of transformation leadership that we've been trying to move into the progressive sector.
Well, those sound like a winning formula there. And, how is your reception been? It seems to me what you're saying would be critical for progressive leaders, and yet so many leaders actually ascend to power because they have exactly the opposite. As you talk about the drive, the ego, it's about me, the sharp elbows sometimes, that's how people often rise to leadership. And yet, you're saying we need to have something different than that. So how are we doing on that in terms of the progressive movement?
Well, let me take you back a few years, just a little story about how I got into this, and that really takes us back to 1969. And I was involved, I was at Harvard, a Harvard student involved in SDS, the Students for Democratic Society. That was sort of the activist group at that time, very involved in anti-war work. And our particular chapter had sort of split into three factions. There was kind of a progressive left faction and a Marxist faction and we were having some troubles, I would say, internally with getting along with each other. And it all came to a head at one meeting, where all of a sudden, like, people were pushing and shouting, trying to grab the microphone from each other. And I had this distinct memory, this woman grabbed the microphone and started screaming into it. And all of a sudden, I felt like I was about 50 feet above the room looking down. And the question was, what would happen if we got the power? And the thought was, we might line up people against the wall and shoot anyone who disagreed with us. And I remember the distinct thought came to me, like, this is not revolutionary. that somehow, if we're going to change the world, that people have to change also, that we can't create a new world from the same place that we're living and thinking and feeling and operating as people. And so that led me in a, really, it's been a 40-year journey, first kind of into the fields of psychology and spirituality, trying to understand, okay, what has to change in human beings? And yet for me, I've always been dedicated to the issues that you opened the show talking about. So it wasn't just me for me to become a better human being, but how can I learn about myself and other human beings in a way that will help us to actually be more effective, more powerful in actually creating the society that we want? So as I kind of, really entered full-time into this work of bringing this work and what I learned to transfer to progressive leaders about 12, 13 years ago, I would say the first, we offered at that point, it was a three-day seminar in, transformation leadership. And the basic reaction was 3 days of navel-gazing?
Right.
I don't have time to pee. I don't have three. Are you kidding? Was the basic response. And, if I look back to my generation in the 60s, out of that kind of period of time, people sort of went one of two ways. They mostly either went towards politics, in changing the externals, or they went towards the world of spirituality and workshops and personal development seminars and therapy. And I would say with a mutual suspicion towards each other to a degree. And I think the general attitude of those who went more towards the political side was they were seeing their friends drop out of politics on a kind of a self-indulgence it could be seen as, or a privilege of those who could afford to do those things and weren't struggling for survival. And I would say that, as I approached bringing this work to political people, there was that suspicion, in a sense, going all the way back to Marx, right? Religion's the opiate of the masses. Like, what is this stuff? And, is it real? And we don't have time for it, and it's expensive. And so there was a lot of suspicion. So, I don't know how my partner, Andre Carruthers, who co-founded Rockwood with myself, he just pulled in all of his friends, just like some hook and crook somehow got people to come. I think he might have paid some of them to come. I have no idea how he got 20, 30 people in the room. And we did this work, and they loved it. I think they were blown away. We did not have trouble filling the next workshop. And, years later, we've run about 6,000 people. Really many of the top leaders in the country have been through our programs at this point. And it's really become a really valued destination, in its reputation as the place to come for leadership development, not for touchy-feely stuff, but like how to become a good leader. And that took some work on our part. I think the trick was, someone who is interested in this personal development, say, they're a progressive leader, they're working in a social justice group or an environmental group, they could go to a personal development seminar, they could go to learn meditation. But maybe they have a really profound experience and learn some important things about themselves. But then Monday morning, they have to come back to, like, the so-called real world. Okay, what do I do with this? How do I integrate this? How does this help me actually do the things I have to do better? And because of my own background, which is very much in the real world, advising leaders of corporations how to run their businesses, I can help them make those linkages so that the work that we brought them isn't just about this inner work of being the change and engaging the heart. It's very much, okay, how do you on Monday morning actually make a more effective organization? Take this principle of being a caring person. How do you fire someone on Monday, by the way, from mm-hmm. a place of being connected to the heart? And so I think because we're able to demonstrate to the people that have come to this work that, hey, this won't just make you feel better. This will actually help you be more effective in getting real results in the changes you're trying to make in the world. Because the people we work with, all these leaders, their whole lives are committed to making a difference. When they can actually see the translation that, that who I am impacts the results I get, and when I do this work about my own leadership development and my own personal mastery, I can actually get better results and be a better leader. Well, they're all for it then, because that's what they're already dedicated to. In fact, because I've taught this kind of work in many different kind of settings, part of what I love about working with progressive leaders and social change activists, not just the impact it has in the world, but also, man, they take to this work, and they take it seriously, because they're serious people trying to do serious things. And so it's actually going really well, much to probably to everyone's shock.
Right. And, I used to think that leaders were born, and, some people just kind of had that gene or tendency or whatever, and they were the ones who emerged as our leaders. As I've gone through life, I think really Vince Lombardi had it right, the famous football coach, when he said, leaders aren't born, they're made. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I agree with it so much. Again, because I think some of that comes from the dominant paradigm pictures of leadership, which are basically white, male, and extroverted and charismatic, right? That's our picture of leadership. And you can't turn someone into that paradigm. But first of all, most people have opportunities to be leaders somewhere in their life. And even if you're a staff person, not the executive director, I mean, so much of work happens out in communities where you need to go out and be a leader. So first of all, almost everyone needs to be a leader. And yes, everyone can find their own place of power and their capacity inside themselves, and that can be nurtured, that can be fostered. We believe everyone has a zone of capacity, that everyone at their best, like, they can get some good things done, and everyone at their worst, well, you know, they create a lot of messes in the world. We believe that everyone can be kind of trained up in that zone so that they can take that capacity that maybe they just get a glimpse of sometimes in some situation, and that can become the new normal, that people can be trained to take what is their own internal capacity, and it can be elevated and empowered and made so that it's more accessible to them in more situations, so that they can be more powerful and more effective in the things they try to move in the world, in whatever their role might be.
Right, and you do a year-long program to train people how to be transformational leaders. So what are some of the kinds of things that you do in the program?
So the program does not have a lot of political content, although part of why I think our programs have been very successful are that they're very immersed in progressive values, that folks don't have to do much translating, that permeating everything we do is an appreciation of racial and gender equity, of class, of economic justice, of human rights. But it's not so much about that. It's about, first of all, this whole area called personal mastery. So we teach people about what is the nature of your power? Where do you draw power from? What's your purpose? What are you doing here on this planet? We start very, very personally. We start on the first day, people go through an exercise in which, in a very deep and real way, they have imagined they have a year to live, and go all the way through looking at their death, looking back at their life, and really reclarifying, like, okay, what am I on this planet for? What do I really care about? And finding that place, a place of power to draw from that we come back to again and again. We do a lot of work on courage, particularly on courageous conversations. A lot of people avoid uncomfortable conversations. And it's funny that these kind of warriors who are so much kind of into conflict out in the world often are very uncomfortable dealing with conflict in their own organizations and their own teams, dealing with people around poor performance, dealing with people around a competition for resources. So we do a lot of training people in mediation, in courageous truth-telling, because we believe that the truth is one of the great powers that activists have to draw on. So these are what we call kind of like that inner work. And then in it, we mix in a very woven way. We'll mix things like, how do you do planning in this time of rapid change? Because really leading experts say the 3-year strategic plan is basically dead. I mean, a lot of groups are still doing it, but the world is changing so quickly, you can no longer make a fixed plan and think you're going to follow it for 3 years. So how do you do planning in a time like that allows for flexibility? We do, how do you lead change in your own organization? Because the world is changing so quickly that organizations have to constantly be morphing and evolving. Many of our leaders are experts in creating campaigns to change the world. How do you change your own organization? Many of our leaders lead very large organizations, you know, with you know, millions of members and, you know, hundreds of staff. If you need to make a shift, a pivot, how do you do that with such a large group? So, again, it's a combination of that inner and that outer. It's very, very personal. You know, I would say most people at the end of the year would say that they experienced what Martin Luther King called beloved community, that people would not be ashamed. They would very much say to each other, I love you. And one of the things the most powerful is that we believe that one of the great barriers towards success of the progressive movement and values is that we're broken into silos around issues. You know, people work on racial justice, or they work on immigration, or they work on climate change, or they work on gender equality. And when everyone kind of got together and elected a president, well, there was a majority of the country, but then the presidency's over, we tend to go back into a kind of our own areas. And so part of the power of the program is not just helping individuals become more effective, it's also weaving across those barriers. So we very deliberately make sure that leaders in every cohort represent all of the major sectors that work out in the world that we believe need to be a family, that need to be a beloved community in the world. We help to create that in the training room so that when they go out after the year into the world, they'll continue those connections, that they commit to each other, that I'll stand for your issue and we'll be at your back.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. And can you tell kind of what the impact is now? Because you've worked with over 300 of the some of the most significant leaders and activists in the progressive movement. Many are household names, which I mentioned earlier, like Move On, the Sierra Club, Greenpeace.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think the individuals who are in your program are different? Are they more effective in their work, and how would you measure their effectiveness?
Oh, my. Those are great questions. I'll offer kind of some vignettes and talk around it a little bit. So the first year, first we were doing these three-day programs, then it became four-day programs. Then we started trying to do a year, because, it's hard to create real behavior change and change in habits and leaders in a four-day program. People have amazing experiences, but they tend to, kind of wear off a bit. So we tried to bring people into a year-long program. Well, the first year, we had trouble filling the program, frankly. And, we were not dealing with presidents of our largest organizations. We were dealing with anyone we could get who would say, I'll come for a year. So flash forward, at this point, we'll often have 200, 250 applications and nominations coming in every year, and we only get to take about 24 of the several hundred people who want to come do the program. So in a sense, that's testimony to the impact that people are saying. We continually hear from people in the organizations, wow, our leader is showing up differently. I can see it. It's having impact on me. It's having impact on our team. So that's anecdotal, but, if you look at the attractiveness of the program, I think that is a testament to the impact it's having. After 10 years of the program, of the year-long, we did have an independent evaluator come in, and they spoke to, I think, close to 100 of our graduates. 97% said it was a life-changing or transformative experience.
What percentage?
97.
97% said this was life-changing.
Well, yeah, life-changing or personally transformed experience. 3% just said it was a great program.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, again, that's soft data, but we see that. And then for us, really what's important, we love helping individuals. We want to see the things move in the world that you all talked about at the beginning. That's really what's at the heart of this program. It's actually a movement-building strategy in the guise of leadership development. And we have a lot of evidence, again, anecdotal, of what these connections are doing in the world. So that when you see things like environmental groups that used to be anti-immigration coming out in support of immigration justice, when you see groups like the National Gay Lesbian Task Force, the NAACP, kind of actively supporting each other's actions and policies, we like to think we had a hand in those things, that those were the relationships that were forged personally. That created deep bonds of trust and understanding of each other as human beings and each other's issues that we're able to translate into change and action in the world.
That's amazing. So this is really an intentional movement-building strategy to encourage, sounds like greater joy in our work, greater effectiveness in our work, and a greater capacity for cross-issue collaboration.
Yes. The other thing I'd like to talk about is sustainability. Really what we historically see in this work is people burning out.
Right.
And it's a kind of culture of almost pride around sacrifice. Literally, people bragging about how little sleep they've had. It's kind of almost a competition to see who's suffering the most.
Mm-hmm.
And what's been interesting is we've tried to reframe that because, yes, it's about personal lifestyle and personal choice, and, maybe some people are willing to sacrifice in that way. We see it as an effectiveness issue, that actually all the things that we're training people to do, people can't do when they're overstressed. People aren't very smart. They're not very strategic. They're not thinking a top leader should always be thinking at least seven years into the future, if not seven generations. When you're frantic, when you have like 15 balls in the air, all you're thinking about is like getting through the day or maybe to the next election. And so we believe that learning how to do this work in a balanced and sustainable way is actually an effectiveness issue. And it's everything to do with collaboration, too, because when people are stressed, all you start caring about is yourself. You don't really have the bandwidth to truly collaborate with others. And that's been helpful to people to reframe it in that way. Okay, it's not just about your quality of life, because, you know, that's your choice. If you're willing to give that up, that's fine. It's actually about you cannot be a great effective leader and someone who can build effective movements when you're running around too crazy.
Right. And you wrote a masterful analysis about progressives and leadership titled What is Transformation? And I encourage all our listeners to read it. It's free on your website, stproject.org. In the article, you identify 7 key factors that limit our effectiveness. And one I'd like to just talk to you about now briefly before we go on the break, but is this ambivalence about power. And you mentioned it earlier, but the reluctance of people say, yes, we want to come from the heart. Yes, we want to be caring, but this person is underperforming and I need to fire them. So can you talk a little bit about this ambivalence about power and how we deal with it?
Yeah, you know, it's the strangest thing because, you know, you start seeing patterns when you kind of do something for a while. And first, you know, it took me a couple of years to realize, wow, isn't this interesting? Our movement, our people, we're all about power, and yet we have this ambivalence about power, and it shows up in a couple of ways. First of all, we see a lot of leaders, you know, well, first of all, people are thrown into leadership in the social change world. You know, one day you're a good organizer, and someone says, great, now you're the director of organizing. You know, if you're good at that, someone suddenly one day says, like, okay, now you're an executive director. And it's like inside you're saying, like, what does an executive director do? and why me? You know, you don't get the kind of training and mentoring that you would kind of rising up a corporate ladder. You're kind of thrown into things. And then many of us carry what we might call the imposter syndrome, which is like, I don't really feel like I'm all that good and powerful inside. I think I've been fooling people. And you see this, I mean, I've seen this with some of our country's most, from the outside, most powerful progressive leaders, you know, presidents of unions, presidents of some of our largest groups, and, you know, in the privacy of coaching, inside they'll go like, I don't feel like a president. You know, I'm just me. And so you see often, I would say, ambivalence, you know, and also, again, we have such ambivalent feelings around power because we've railed against power and the abuse of power, and we've spoken truth to power. Well, all of a sudden you have power yourself, like you're in charge. And for many of our folks, it's actually hard to tell people what to do. You know, you see people putting their teams to these kind of just exhausting collective processes when the leader actually knows what they want them to do, but somewhat just shy about saying, we're going here. So you see that on the one side. Then on the other side, you see many of the folks, of us people who kind of like work in social change groups, are ambivalent about being led. At Greenpeace, a board chair of Greenpeace, well, sort of our motto in the world, so the world is like, no compromise. Okay, well, like all of a sudden, we're like trying to have a members meeting with 125 members, and when we disagree with each other, our impulse might be to do an action on each other. So when you spent your life kind of railing against the abuse of power by those in authority, well, all of a sudden, your own organization, many of us don't really feel like anyone telling us what to do. So you sort of have on the one side many leaders who are ambivalent about exercising their power and a lot of staff who may be ambivalent about not having power. And then the other thing is we often have, a lot of our groups don't pay a lot. You often see a lot of the staff are very young, fresh out of college, and their ideals about democracy haven't had a chance to kind of be tested yet in the real world. Really, it's interesting. When I used to work with corporations a long time ago, I felt so much of my work was trying to kind of relax hierarchy and kind of create more space for people to have a say in what was going on. And in social change groups, I feel like the opposite's happening. It's like having to establish that legitimate authority that's actually okay for some people to have more authority and to exercise it appropriately.
Great. We need to pause now for the break. We'll pick this up shortly. This is Eleanor Lacaine speaking with my guest, Robert Gass, co-founder of the Rockward Leadership Institute. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacain speaking with my guest, Robert Gass, the co-founder of the Rockward Leadership Institute. Before the break, we were talking about how progressives often have ambivalence to having power. You know, the day job is to rail against the power that's being so destructive to so many people, and yet needing to have an exercise power to run an effective organization and to make effective social change. So, Robert, how do you deal with that? What do you say to the leaders in the progressive movement? How do we get over this ambivalence about power and use it in a way that is in service to good?
Well, the first thing I'd like to say, just reflecting back on our conversation, I want to say how inspired I've been by the people I work with over the last 12, 13 years, the people who kind of put themselves into this public service to lead social change and give their lives to it. These people are unbelievably committed. They will give anything to their people, to their communities, to move this work forward. And that's what we have to draw from. It's like when they're given a chance to kind of step out of the action, you know, and actually reflect, you know, and the other thing is that leaders become very isolated. You know, one day you're kind of peers with people in a team, and the next day you're like director or executive director. Well, a strange thing starts happening. People who you were friends yesterday don't talk to you anymore in the same way because they're now looking at you as the leader. And so our leaders are very, very isolated. And one of the beautiful things about the trainings, when they get a chance, is all of a sudden they're talking to other leaders, and they get a chance to talk about these things. And so a lot of it it's not what I say. It's what people know and what they can learn from each other when they're given a chance where it feels safe to actually talk to other leaders. Because when you're a leader, there are a lot of things you can't talk about to people. You can't talk about those struggles, those ambivalences. And so the first thing is when leaders start talking to each other, they start saying, oh, my God, everyone feels this way. You know, and so like in the group, you know, you're running a smaller social justice group, and here's the head of one of the large national organizations. Like, they're your idol, and all of a sudden they're saying they feel insecure. Well, it's like all of a sudden everyone realizes that every leader has trouble sleeping at night sometimes. You know, you're supposed to be inspiring the people about working on climate change, and inside at night you're saying they're scared at night, like scared for your children and your grandchildren. How do you show up in the morning giving hope to people when you don't feel it inside? When you're not sure where the money's coming from, you know, you may have to lay off staff. How do you walk in the next day, you know, and project, you know, confidence that everything's going to be okay? And so when leaders get a chance to talk to each other, it becomes very humanizing. They see that, yeah, everyone wrestles with these things, and it's okay. And they challenge each other. It's like, yeah, we got to get on with it. Yeah, you know what? This person's like a friend. I've known this person for years, and like they've not been performing, and I need to confront them and tell them to get with it or to get out. So again, it's like it's not just what I say; it's the opportunity that people have to learn when they can step out of that, you know, the chaos and intensity of their day-to-day work as leaders, sort of go to the mountaintop. And a lot of it's self-reflection, and it's what they learn from each other.
That's great, and I wanted to go back to what you said earlier about how the progressive movement at one point split into those who were very politically active and those who went more deeply spiritual. And your training explicitly addresses spirituality. And as you say, many progressives think of spirituality as, you know, from the Marx quote, religion is the opiate of the masses. So somehow progressives seem to have lost connection to the spiritual that went so deep with Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and with Gandhi. So how do you see that integration? How do you deal with spirituality in your training, and how is that received among progressives who are often very anti-spiritual?
Well, it depends what you mean by spirituality. Again, many people confuse spirituality with religion. And so we give people a number of ways to find that in themselves. I talked about the exercise we do where people kind of contemplate their own mortality and look at their own year to live. We help people to understand, what is your purpose? That seems to be something that everyone can understand, that people can connect with. And that starts to lead people into a different territory than you know, analyzing the economic indicators and, you know, and the kind of policies that need to change. It takes people into their own heart, into their own spirit, if you will. And so before they can be a spiritual leader for others, they have to find, we have to find that connection inside ourselves. And what we do is we give people a lot of space to find it in their own way, to find their own language for it. Ritual, of course, is one of the ways that historically people find that connection to something larger than themselves. The challenge is we live in we're actually all a country of immigrants except for those who are Native American, and we don't have common rituals anymore. And so in our trainings, we try to create rituals that are spacious, that allow people to find their own way to that thing that is profoundly meaningful to them. So, for example, in the first retreat, when people come, we ask them to bring something that to them symbolizes the connection to their own heritage, to their own ancestral their own culture, to their own ancestral lineage. And so people bring things very personal, very precious to them. You know, their pictures of their grandparents. Many of them will bring kind of cultural objects, cultural icons or religious icons, things that are very meaningful to them. And so one of the very first things we do is we stand in a circle and everyone talks about the object they bring. We kind of lay it down in a collective altar, if you will. And so that kind of, everyone has that inside of them. And I think people get hung up when it's supposed to look like something or it's supposed to mean something other than what it does to them. So we give people a lot of space. We guide them to that already is living deep within them and is meaningful to them and help them own that. And then it's like, okay, as they feel that connection, I feel who I am and what connects me to something larger than myself. Larger than myself could be a relationship to the Creator. Larger than myself could be a connection to nature. Larger than myself could be a connection to my community. It could be a connection to my ancestors, to my culture. It could be a connection to the arc of history. But that's what makes a great leader. It's not about me. It's about me in service to this larger thing that I not only serve, but I can draw power from, I can draw meaning from. And so as people start to feel that, then our job as midwives, in the sense of great leaders, is to help start giving the confidence to bring that out to the world, to speak from that place, to connect to that power, and to recognize that that is within everybody that they're speaking to. And how do I call that out to other people? How do I create a vision? Van Jones, one of our wonderful leaders these days, done so much good work. He said, Martin Luther King didn't say, I have a strategy. He said, I have a dream. And so as a leader, when I say to people, you have to become a spiritual leader, it's not a religious leader, but how do you speak in a way that speaks to people's hearts, to people's spirits, that elevates, that calls that power and that meaning out of them?
That's beautiful. So you don't get too much blowback from atheists in the group?
Never.
No. Wonderful.
No, because it's not, again, I just mentioned five ways that you might find that connection.
Mm-hmm.
And so when someone who does not have any experience or maybe disbelief in there being a creator in the universe, well, that's fine because they can find it through their culture, through their ancestors, through their love for their community. I mean, we create that space.
Wonderful. You lay out 9 key principles of transformative social change in the article I mentioned, and the principles include things like taking a whole systems approach, being the change we want to see, which you've talked about, engaging the heart. What do you think are some of the most important principles for transformative social change?
I would say the one that I probably emphasize the most is this notion of systemic change. If you look at change efforts in the world, mostly they fail. If you look at individual change, let's look at psychotherapy. Pretty much every research shows 50% of the time it works, half the time it doesn't work. McKinsey company did a research on organizational change efforts around the world. 70% of attempts to change organizations fail, which is a scary statistic. I mean, billions of dollars are spent. Would you want to go into surgery with a 70% failure rate? And you spoke at the beginning, about our efforts to transform society. Some good changes are happening, but a lot of them do fail. Why do they fail? Well, I think, you very wise at the beginning said, part of why they fail is there's some fairly organized opposition or forces kind of pushing in the other way that are pretty embedded and powerful. Okay, and that's so. But then you also, what can we do? One of the things I think that we fail to do is that we don't attend to a whole system. What we do is we tend to kind of take one thing we want to change, one piece, and we'll kind of push on that piece. And while we're pushing, we may actually see some change start to happen, But then we kind of stopped pushing, and because this thing we were trying to change was connected to other parts of a system, it's like a rubber band. What looked like change starts to get pulled back into place because we didn't attend to the entire system. So you try to give people better housing, and you get them, you take them from where they are, and you're now in their better house. But if they don't have a good job, they may not be able to keep that house. These things get connected like this. And I think the hardest place, the most important bit to connect, is it's the inner work and the outer work. So we use a model called the wheel of change. Basically, to change anything in the world, you have to address three domains of human experience. You have to change the way the hearts and minds, the way people think, the way people feel. You also need to change behavior. What do people actually do and don't do every day? And then you need to change the structures and systems inside which people live. You have to change all three. We on the left, traditionally, but certainly the last 20, 30 years, we tend to focus on systems. We have to change government policies. We have to change the structures of society. And we do. And yet we're very often not speaking to the hearts and minds of the people, the changes that would have to happen for them. We often try to change people with statistics. Failing to kind of engage our understanding, actually, people have kind of embedded belief systems, and they'll sort and change those statistics to fit how they actually believe. So that's one thing we most emphasize is, okay, to actually be a transformational leader, you're going to have to, in every situation, attend to what has to change in the hearts and minds of people, what has to change in behavior, and what are the systems and structures that have to change.
That's great. And one of the things you're highly respected and beloved for is the fact that you live the values that you're espousing, and you're kind of a walking model of transformational leadership. You had an experience in Mexico once where you were captured by bandits and you and your family had your lives threatened. Are you willing to share that story with us now?
Sure I am. And thank you. It's actually a story I haven't shared in a long time. I used to share it a lot, and it's not that it's not a beautiful story. It just sort of went out of my attention. But it does, in a way, it does capture certainly the essence of being the change and how changing the inside can change the outside. So, yeah, I think it would be a good story to share. It was... I have to go through my daughter's age here. She was two, so we're not talking 35 years ago, 33 years ago, we were camping with my wife and I and our then 2-year-old daughter, camping in Baja. And we'd rented a small camper, and we were camping near a beach. And I'm a very sound sleeper. All of a sudden, my wife is kind of like poking me in the other thing, wake up, wake up. And I was kind of, it was kind of a little loft area, a little raised platform. We were sleeping. I'm kind of waking up, and all of a sudden, there are people banging and crashing. I'm naked. And I kind of like jump down and I look, open my eyes, and there are masked men kind of pounding on the windshield trying to break it open. I woke up really quickly, adrenaline pouring through my body. And so I sort of dove for the steering wheel, got myself in the seat, turned the key. I was sure somehow we were going to get away. Well, this car had started perfectly. Every other time I'm turning it and it's kind of like turning over and not catching. And all of a sudden the window crashes open, and all of a sudden my hand gets cut with a knife or a machete, and all of a sudden there's a gun in my throat, and I realize we're not going to get away. Up to that moment, I wasn't scared. I was just kind of like all action. They come in. They start shouting. They're shouting in Spanish. There are four of them.
They come into your van.
Oh, yeah. They're into the van. I'm kind of, pushed back. My wife and daughter kind of huddled in a blanket in the back. One had a pistol, one had a machete, one had a knife. They were all masked. They were shouting in Spanish. Pretty crazed. It was interesting because I wasn't scared when I had something to do. I was just all adrenaline. But all of a sudden, I was kind of helpless. And then I started like shaking. I was getting very scared. And I had enough presence of mind. One of the things that I do teach is. I believe that we have an intuitive mind, a place of clarity, a place of inner wisdom that can provide us with guidance, if you will, about how do we need to meet this moment in life. And so I was scared, but I sort of remembered to do that, and I kind of went inside and kind of said, okay, what do I need to know here? and I heard very, very quickly the words of the 23rd Psalm. I heard the line, "Thou shalt prepare us a table before me in the presence of mine enemies." I can remember my first, I was like, okay, what the hell does that mean? Great. You know, oh, that's what they pray when they're taking you to a death sentence. But then it was interesting. I kind of re-looked at them for a moment, and what I saw was like, these are kids. Hmm. Like, I kind of saw past the math. Like, these are really kids, and these are really inexperienced band. What they were doing is they're making a terrible mess. They're throwing things all over the place. They're burying a lot of the good goods. These are clearly incompetent young kids who don't know what they're doing. And that sort of changed everything. And then I said, what if they weren't my enemies? What if they were friends of mine in from the cold desert night? And what if I was preparing it? So what I saw this image of literally preparing a table, like, welcome them to a feast was the image I saw. Hmm. And once I saw them, that they were kids, human beings, right? Not just like some image of bandits. Some kind of mental shift happened inside. And so I said, what would I do if I was preparing a table? Well, I would offer them some, I would think differently. And at first, one of them spoke a little bit of English. And I said to him, if you look in that drawer over there, you're going to find a Walkman. Until a little while ago, so it was a cassette Walkman. And he looked at me rather strange. He opens up the drawer, and there's the Walkman. And I said, and over there, you find my wallet and some money. And I said to him, you're making a mess. Why don't you have your people sit down, and I'll take all the good stuff and give it to you.
So you're becoming a guide to the bandits.
I was serving them. Like I do everybody else in my life. I'm kind of a good guy. I'm always helping people. I try to help them. It took seeing a couple things before I believe he kind of calmed them all down. They're sitting down. And so now it's kind of like show and tell. Here's a nice guitar. Who would like this? I kind of brought all things from one of the things, kind of show them. I give them to various things. Kind of totally shifted the energy. There was one of the guys was really, I think, on drugs. He was really drunk. He kept yelling, drugs, drugs. He was a little crazy. He found my bottle of Lomatil, which is what you take, to kind of stuff up when you have diarrhea. I hope you had a good time taking that. the scene kind of changed, and they found all my, I gave them all the good stuff, and then we were done with that. And I said, well, now what we should have some food. So I went to the refrigerator. Now there was a cultural problem, because inside the refrigerator were things like yogurt and sprouts and tofu, and I wasn't sure there was anything that they would recognize as food. But then there was an apple. So I picked up the apple, and I kind of handed towards the guy who spoke a little bit of English. And there was an interesting moment there, because these things are often happening at a deeper level. And in every culture, the sharing of food together, something happens. It's a sacred act. It's like you're no longer enemies in that moment, even if they're an enemy. When you share food, when you break bread together. And there was like a hesitation on his part. But then he reaches out, and it's funny. I remember it. I remember this moment. It was kind of like, it felt like the moment in E.T., like when our hands touched with the apple. And I felt something happen. I felt like we made a connection of a different kind.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, they had everything. We had some food, and then they wanted to know where the key was. And then it looked like they were going to drive away with us. Well, this entire time.
Still in the van.
We're in the van, and my wife and the two-year-old are naked, kind of in a blanket in the back.
Still have the gun and the machete.
Oh, yeah, they still have it, but they, at that moment they weren't threatening, because the vibe really did change.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, they had their weapons, but they weren't, threatening me or anything. And then they said, we're driving, you come with us. Well, I didn't like that idea at all. And so what's interesting was I got afraid again. And I got afraid, and I started thinking, well, why don't you leave us here? And then we started arguing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I kind of saw, okay, when I get afraid, we're back into being bandits and victims, and this is like this potential for violence. So I went, okay, we'll go with you. Okay. So they start driving along. I'm talking to my wife now in the back as they're driving, and we're saying, what the hell is going on? These people do not seem competent to pull off a kidnapping. But if they're going to kill us, they would have just killed us there. Where are we going? So, we're driving along. Every once in a while, we pass kind of lights and things at this picture. Maybe I should, open the door and throw my wife and daughter out.
Mm-hmm.
But then we're driving along. I say, what do I usually do when I'm kind of driving along in a car with friends? Well, we always sing together. We always do music. I'm a musician. And so I got the guitar back, and we started singing. And so we started singing one of our kind of hippie songs that we sang in those days, you know, like, listen, listen, listen to my heart song. Well, we felt good, but they weren't into that so much. And then I kind of said, well, if I was a good host, I'd try to find something they would like, too.
Now, just so you know, we have about one more minute to go.
Great. So we started singing Guantanamera. And all of a sudden, they're singing Guantanamera. They pull us out. They park. My wife and I look at each other because we think they're going to kill us. And actually, no, they've driven themselves home. They walk out of the car, and the guy with the gun and spoke English started giving me money back. He said, you need some money for the gasoline. I hope we haven't ruined your vacation. I hope you won't think bad things of our people. We're poor people. We have to do these things. And we had reached a very different level of reality and connection because of the shift inside. The world changed outside.
That is an amazing story. So, it says to me, among many things, but really the transformative power of love.
Transformative power and be the change.
And be the change.
That you want to see in the world.
Yeah, because it's entirely possible those bandits had intended to kidnap or kill you, and then it ended up in a good place. That is just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. Well, I appreciate you sharing the story and all of your good work. I want to let people know, if you want to learn more about the work of Robert Gass, you can get the information on trainings for leaders and also the retreats for couples that Robert does with his wife Judith at sacredunion.com. And there is a ton of really helpful publications and transformational tools for leaders that you can get for free on his website, thestproject.org. Is there anything else you want to say before we close, Robert?
No, it's been a delight being with you, Eleanor. Thank you so much for what you do on this show and what you bring to the world.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. In case you've missed any of our programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next week. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.